Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what, I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
Before. It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best in new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning. Welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. Got Julian Paul here live in the studio. Yes. On this rather miserable Saturday morning. It's absolutely chucking it down and it's rather windy. It's Saturday, the 4th of October 2025, just in case you're listening on catch up. Later in this hour, we'll be speaking to RPG. He's doing, bits and pieces, or piece by piece even, maybe. And this week, and indeed every first Saturday of the month, our guest speaker is Phil Muffett from the Mexpert and Swinton Astronomical Society. He'll be talking about Iron Sky, club news and all sorts of stuff like that. And no doubt there'll be something about the weather as well. All being well, next week, and indeed every second Saturday of the month, our guest speaker is Dr. Ogo Osamor. All being well. Loads to talk about today, how we're going to fit it all in. We'll do our best. First up, multiple sclerosis trial boosts treatment hopes. Saw this in the press last week. Doctors in Cambridge believe they are on the brink of a new class of treatments for multiple sclerosis, or MS for short, after a trial in patients suggested nerve damage can be repaired. The treatment involves combining the common diabetes drug metformin with clemastine, an antihistamine actually, to repair myelin, the protective membrane around nerve cells. It becomes damaged in multiple sclerosis and causes symptoms such as fatigue, pain, spasms and problems with walking. Previous evidence from animal studies found metformin enhanced the effect of clemastine on myelin repair, but until now the two drugs have never been tested together in people. So Dr. Nick Cunliffe, who's an academic neurologist at Cambridge University who led the trial, said, "We still need to research long-term benefits and side effects of the drugs, But in my opinion, he says, my instinct is we're on the brink of a new class of treatments to stop the progression of MS. And possibly within the next decade, we could see the first licensed treatment that repairs myelin and improves the lives of people with multiple sclerosis. Dr. Emma Gray, who's a director of research at the MS Society, which funded the trial, said the results were exciting. 70 people with relapsing multiple sclerosis took part in the six-month trial. Half of them were given a drug combination and the rest had a placebo. Experts then measured how quickly signals travel between the eyes and the brain. The speed of signals slowed in the placebo group but were constant in the drug group. People did not feel better on the drugs but had no serious side effects. And multiple sclerosis affects more than 150,000 people in the UK who have to live with that condition. So I thought that was a rather interesting article, possible research leading to some breakthroughs in the next decade or so. These are how long things take. And I couldn't resist but do this. This is RPG's up his street, but I couldn't miss this. Sunday Times Good University Guide 2025. Sheffield University. It's gone up a place from last year, up to 13 ranked overall. I think that's an astonishing achievement. Shame is that nothing. It can't quite be said the same for Sheffield Hallam University, who's diving down that leaderboard for whatever reason. So, University of Sheffield, though, the Yorkshire University, located in a city famed for steel, is forging a path up our academic league table, up one place to 13th overall. This rise is powered by outstanding student satisfaction, earning it the title of University of the Year for Student Experience this year. This follows its runner-up award for our overall University of the Year last year. So they're doing great. And there's some fantastic facts in that article as well in the Good University Guide. So the 1905 founded Sheffield University evolved from three 19th century institutions. That's Sheffield Medical School, Firth College and Sheffield Technical School. A member of the Russell Group, Sheffield's reputation for research is world class. Sheffield University ranks 15th in the Sunday Times Research Quality Index, with 92% of its work rated world leading or internationally excellent in the latest Research Excellence Framework. And it recently broke into the top 100 of the QS World University Rankings. Its academic clout is underlined by six Nobel Prize winners and its highly regarded Advanced Manufacturing Research Centre, AMRC, which is just off Sheffield Parkway, and it's actually in Rotherham, but all good stuff. And bucking the trend among Russell Group universities, Sheffield University ranks in the top 20 for teaching quality in the latest analysis. I just found the article fascinating. Very proud to be from Sheffield, therefore. Sheffield University led the way with the first documented use of penicillin for therapy in 1930.
Wow.
Now it is investing in facilities at its new Faculty of Health, which has brought dedicated pharmacy teaching suites and mock clinical wards for students of medicine, nursing and midwifery. Philosophy, archaeology, history and the Digital Humanities Institute have been brought under one roof at 9 Mapping Street to support collaborative working. Financial assistance is generous. Merit-based scholarships include more than 250 experienced Sheffield scholarships at £3,600 awarded to successful academic applicants whose household incomes are no more than £50,000. And from Russell Group universities, only Cardiff and Queen Mary University of London recruit more students from non-selective state schools than Sheffield, which has 78.4%. And this is also interesting as well. Sheffield is a go-to destination for top employers, ranking among the top 20 most targeted universities in the UK, according to the High Flyers Report 2025. It places 22nd in our analysis of the Graduate Outcomes Survey, with 82.9% of leavers from Sheffield University in higher highly skilled jobs or postgraduate study. And a long-standing partnership with Siemens has made Sheffield its leading UK supplier of graduates who take part in hackathons, curriculum engagement and internships. And the Civil Service Policy Campus in Sheffield provides local job opportunities too. So they're blowing a bit of a trumpet for good old University of Sheffield because it's up against some other fantastic universities in the UK. I think top is London School of Economics yet again. Oxford and Cambridge, of course, are always up there, but good old Sheffield University, number 13, and University of the Year for Student Experience.
Yeah, and Paul like that because he's well into them as well, isn't he?
But yeah, well done, Sheffield. Elsewhere in the science news, before we talk to RPG, a few more stories.
Right, an agreement to conserve biodiversity across two-thirds of the world's oceans has cleared the threshold to become international law, after Morocco became the 60th country to ratify it. The High Seas Treaty, which will take effect in January 2026, establishes legal binding rules to conserve marine biodiversity, create more protected areas, and strengthen scientific cooperation.
The next story I'm sure RPG will be interested in as well. According to South West Water, a trial that uses artificial intelligence, or AI for short, to predict if sewers are becoming blocked has helped cut pollution. Artificial intelligence analysed data from 12,000 sensors on the network, monitoring how water levels were rising and falling to help determine if a sewer was blocked and could be about to overflow. The project was part of a pollution incident reduction plan to improve environmental performance, and as part of the trial, which was developed over 2 years, artificial intelligence was also used to process hours of CCTV footage of sewage infrastructure to look for defects or blockages in wastewater pipes. Now, normally that would have been done manually, so a very interesting development there.
Yes, a small family farm near Ely, or
Ely
in Cambridgeshire, is preparing to harvest what may be the UK's first rice crops by re-wetting land to combat centuries of soil loss. Working with scientists, the team at Ox Willow Farm is exploring how rising the water table can protect carbon-rich peat soils and enable crops like rice, as well as ones more familiar to the UK, such as celery and lettuce, to thrive in a changing climate. The trial has also boosted local wildlife and water supply, attracting interest from supermarkets and offering a potential model for sustainable farming in the face of the climate crisis.
Indeed. In a future show, I've got lots of articles I want to talk about. One is an interview with Raymond Blanc, who's stepping down as chef proprietor at Le Manoir in Oxfordshire, the two Michelin-starred restaurant. I've always fancied it, but expensive, though. And he's talking about the importance of soil to what we grow. And you can have a poor crop, you know, that grows on a poor variety of vegetable or fruit that grows on poor soil, and you'll never have a good fruit. It was very interesting, so we'll be talking about that. But it's all about climate change as well. But finally, a Cambridge academic has called for the UK to emulate the forest school model and introduce more outdoor lessons as part of a more holistic approach to education. In her new book, Rewilding Education, Professor Hilary Cremant says that schools should adopt experience-based learning such as planting trees, creating school gardens, or nature-inspired arts activities to foster greater respect for the environment.
Thank you.
track that. Edited version, though, of The Forest by The Cure. 1980, can you believe that is? I think they're on tour as well. Played that because the Cambridge Academic has called for the UK to emulate the Forest School model to teach people greater respect for the environment. Of course, listen to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM. We should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
It's a rather soggy morning, isn't it?
It's a wet one, as they say.
It is. Yeah. I bet the cat's inside.
Yeah, he's not impressed by the changeable wind direction.
I know. Hey, oh, I'm lucky we're not in in Scotland, that's what I would say.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a lovely place, Scotland.
It is, but perhaps not in this rain and wind. I think we need the rain. I'm not sure about the wind business. So what's caught your eye in the science news this week then, Paul?
Oh, well, let's start on a kind of personal front, I guess. That I think I mentioned that recently I had COVID again.
Lucky and, you, eh?
Yeah, great start. But some stats came out which say that the COVID hospital cases suggest that there's going to be an autumn wave of COVID. So the hospitalisations have jumped by 37% in just a week. That's in last week. And it's the highest level in nearly a year, fueling concerns that we'll have this autumn wave. Admission in England rose to 2.73 people per 100,000 in the week from 21st of September, compared with 2 in the previous week, and that's their highest level since November 2024. So it seems that it's on the move again. There are a couple of variants that are doing the rounds, but I popped in to see my doctor and said, I was wondering about my COVID top-up for this year. And they said, oh, well, check with reception. And I said, I don't think you can have one. So I said, huh? Pardon? So I seem to have crept into this magic hole, past 70, but not right, not reached 75, where unless you've got specific health conditions, mine used to qualify, asthma, but apparently now it doesn't. So I can no longer have a free COVID top-up. So I had a quick look round, and the cost appears to be fairly regular around the country at just a scrape under £100, £98,
£99. Yeah, it's a lot of money, that, isn't it?
Yeah, and thinking about the idea of the top-up is to stop me having worse conditions, I would have thought that the age group, certainly above 75, you qualify for the top-up. Below 70, you've got specific conditions that you have to have before you can get a free top-up. But it seems to me that it's a very strange thing, and I can't find any evidence or sort of storyline as to why this has happened.
Very interesting.
Yeah, but say, especially this time of year, just a reminder to everybody, keep sanitising your hands, washing your hands. Make sure if you're going to travel on public transport, be prepared to wear a mask again. It's sort of certainly doing the rounds, and I say it's not one, but at least a couple of variations, which are quite transmissible from all accounts. And a strange thing about what to do, but if you're in my age bracket, then start saving up your 100 quid if you want to have a top up.
Are you eligible for the flu jab then?
I had my flu jab on Thursday, which is an interesting one. So I say it was very strange to, because I just said that as a matter of course, I'll just check on when are you doing the COVID top up jabs. To suddenly say, oh, well, hang on a minute, I'll check for you. And then they rang me back after a day and said, you don't qualify.
Blacklist.
This is where Paul's wishing he's 75 now. But no, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because they're saying COVID's like going to become like flu.
Yeah.
You know?
Well,
so
I think it smacks of sort of herd immunity, but let's say for the specific age group, you would have thought that there is higher risk. But hey. I don't know. I shall look out with interest to see if we get some kind of explanation from higher up areas of the country, government and medicine. But that's a bit of a personal one that I thought would be interesting to anybody
in my
age group. Also some news that mosquitoes have been evolving to survive new insecticides. So British scientists have discovered genetic clues on how malaria-carrying mosquitoes are evading the efforts to control them. So a team examined the Anopheles funestus, one of the most prolific malaria-transmitting mosquitoes in Africa, and discovered how the species is managing to evolve to survive. So it will inform further work that's been done now to develop more control for malaria to the point of elimination. But one of the most widespread mosquito species in Africa, with a significantly longer lifespan than other malaria transmitting mosquitoes, the females are attracted to humans as a source of blood which they need to develop their eggs. So it's brilliant at adapting. So in some areas it's evolved from biting indoors in the evening to biting outdoors during the day. So it's likely to be the response to people using mosquito nets at night. But the new work was published in Science magazine, and experts collected and sequenced the genomes of 656 modern and Fustus specimens and 45 historic specimens from the Natural History Museum in London and the French National Research Institute for Sustainable Development. So samples from equatorial countries shared genetic similarities despite covering a 4,000 kilometre range, and one key mutation linked to insecticide resistance, which is widespread among the populations present from the 60s. The other mutations that make mosquitoes resistant to insecticides were absent, suggesting that they became beneficial only at different insecticides were used in subsequent decades. So basically, it's a bit of a battle through time with the mosquitoes evolving their patterns and themselves to adapt to the current environment in terms of insecticides. So I think it was something which then really sort of, I thought, in terms of that, I'd look at the BBC Science Focus magazine. And there's a great article in there by Dr. Helen Scales. And she's talking about millions of years before dinosaurs began roaming the Earth. Strange-looking creatures scuttling across the seabed. And they looked like they were wearing spiked helmets with little eyes on top and a sharp tail sticking out to the back. Mm-hmm. And nowadays we call them horseshoe crabs. They're still around today, and they belong to an order of animals known as Kyphosaura, which is derived from the Greek words meaning sword and tail. And despite the name, they're not actually crustaceans, but are more closely related to spiders. So what's the interest in them? Well, even though they've been around, fossils have been found dating back 450 million years. They have quite an important role in modern life. So the article says most people will at some point have crossed paths with a life-saving dose of the horseshoe crab's vital blue blood.
Oh.
So the blue colour comes from oxygen-carrying pigment hemocyanin, and it's an equivalent to the red hemoglobin in vertebrate blood. But crucially, their blood contains a powerful group of immune cells called amebocytes, which are which are highly sensitive to dangerous toxins produced by bacteria. And endotoxins are ubiquitous in the environment and aren't easily removed by sterilization. So if vaccines contain endotoxins, this can lead to potentially lethal reaction known as injection fever. And in the past, batches of vaccines were tested by injecting them into live rabbits.
Aww.
And if any of them developed a fever, this showed the vaccines were contaminated. Back in the 1960s, marine biologists in America noticed that horseshoe crabs' blue blood instantly coagulated when exposed to fever-inducing endotoxins, and that protected horseshoe crabs from invading bacteria, and they did that by forming clots around them. And they said it's also proved useful in humans. So now, instead of injecting rabbits, hundreds of thousands of live horseshoe crabs are taken from the sea each year and lined up to have a third of their blood drained to use for endotoxins in intravenous drugs and medical implants.
Blimey.
So the demand soared recently with the development of, guess what? COVID-19
vaccine. Let me go.
not
You're
all
not
the
thinking
horseshoe...
you're going to get a crab, are you, Paul? From somewhere?
No.
Do your own vaccine.
Yeah, unfortunately, not all of the crabs survive this bloodletting.
Oh, dear. Poor things.
15 to 30% of them die, and leading conservationists are now calling for blood tests to be replaced by synthetic alternatives. So in the 1990s, researchers in Singapore developed a process for creating synthetic endotoxin detecting compounds based on the horseshoe crab's DNA. And now there are several versions of it available that mimic the reaction without using any of the crab's blood. So regulators are slow, but the new compounds are approved for use in Europe in 2016 and in the US in 2024. Now, pharmaceutical companies are increasingly turning to these synthetic alternatives. And that's good news, not just for the crabs, but for other species that depend on them.
Yeah, well, exactly. It's a food chain, isn't it?
Yeah. And each year, thousands of horseshoe crabs crawl onto sandy beaches along the east coast of North America, especially the Delaware Bay near Philadelphia, to mate and lay their eggs. A single female can lay around 4,000 eggs, and many will become vital food for migrating birds. So an ancient creature that's got modern use, and hopefully now modern science is going to help it to survive a bit longer rather than becoming just a source of blood for...
Well, what a story that is.
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting one, and it kind of tied into some of the other things that I've been talking about. So, and another strange one, I think, is that... marine life has been found to be thriving on Second World War munitions dumps. So these are munitions that have been dumped into the Baltic Sea in an area around the Lübeck Bay. And researchers discovered that V1, the flamed bomb called Doodlebugs here in the UK, and the warheads were dumped at sea and to get rid of them, essentially, at What they've found now is that there are many more, five times as many organisms living on discarded munitions. So,
wow, why is that then?
Yeah, well, it seems they were one of a series of vengeance. From the Communications Earth and Environment report, underlined the resilience of the marine ecosystems and enduring environmental legacy of the wartime waste, because it provides a hard, flat surface which a lot of things can grow on and attach themselves to. They seem to have into this 42,000 organisms per square metre are living on the hard metal casings of discarded bombs, compared to about 8,200 in normal sort of nearby sediments. So they're saying similar abundances of marine life have been previously recorded on natural hard surfaces in the bay. And yet the apparent boom does come with risks, because the chemical analysis of the concentration of explosive compounds in surrounding water vary from as little as 30 nanograms per litre to as much as 2.7 milligrams per litre, a level which is estimated to be toxic to marine life.
Wow.
So making the best of, yet again, mankind's ability to dump all sorts of rubbish into the ocean.
Nature has a way of, working itself out. I still think the story about the mosquitoes, I just think that, They've given up thinking about biting indoors at night, because everybody's got nets and stuff. So they're biting outdoors. Yeah. I mean, that just shows what nature does.
Yeah, absolutely.
to survive.
It's fantastic. I think the variety of things that happen in nature, and I say some of the things that we as humankind do to the world.
Indeed. And on that note, we've got a cracking track for you, Paul. Instead of Bits and Pieces, it's Piece by Piece by The Answer.
Oh, great. I can listen to that.
It'll wake you up anyway, if nothing else. It's Belter. We'll be playing on Glory Days soon. So speak to you Monday, 1 till 3, Glory Days Rock Show.
Look forward
bye
to
bye
it.
Bye-bye, Paul. Bye.
Cheers. Bye. Bye.
Feel is in the space, and when I'm just about to
that's quite a track, that. Piece by Piece by The Answer. Played that because our Paul was talking about all sorts of stuff. You are, of course, listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning, 11 till 12. We should have Phil Muffet on the line.
I wish I was a spaceman, the fastest guy alive. I'd fly you round the universe in Fireball XL5. Way out in space together, conquers of the sky. My heart would be a fireball.
Morning, Phil.
Good morning.
So where are you? Under the stairs, by any chance?
I'm in my office.
You're in your office. Can't you find a better office then than under the stairs?
No, it's nice.
Is it?
Small can be nice.
Hello, Harry.
Small can be nice and away from everything.
Hello, Harry.
So for people who don't know who you are, Phil, you are a member of, I was going to say, and also president of, but you're not, are you? Member of Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society.
Yeah, I'm not president yet.
You're not have you ever been president? No.
No.
Ever want to be?
I don't know.
Don't know?
Sometimes you're better off keeping under the radar.
Because actually, being in charge can be quite difficult, can't it?
It can. Well, the other thing is, I mean, I've been on the Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society committee since the fourth week I was a member.
Wow.
But the problem is, which is like 40-odd years ago, 50 years ago, but the problem is, an organisation doing things. So it's like the past couple of years, after I got like a bit of a back seat job where I'm on the committee but I'm not in charge of anything.
Yeah.
So it's given me the opportunity to do astronomy when I've not been doing it for so many years. I mean, obviously I do astronomy, but what I mean is the nuts and bolts stuff is really getting your telescope out, understanding, learning the sky and seeing things in the flesh and blood. Because we get so much stuff fed to us now on the internet, all these fantastic pictures and all these simulator computer programs, which is brilliant, don't get me wrong. But at the essence of it, when you cut it all back to basics, going out, looking at the moon, looking at the planets, looking at the stars, seeing meteorites, it's all fantastic. And understanding where stuff's in the sky,
that's a challenge in itself. And to be fair, Phil, as we're talking, the wind is whipping around the window. There's a gale blowing, a storm, you know. So how much actual observing have you managed to do then?
Well, this month, last month, I think I've managed 2 to 3 nights observing. And it's either because, it's been because of cloud and rain. Well, when I say rain, it's been mainly cloud and just bad weather. And the problem is, I'm an evening astronomer rather than a morning astronomer. So I like to do an hour and then pack my gear away. So I get it all prepared, set up. I know what I'm doing for the evening. I'll have an hour at it, take what photos or find what objects I am, and work through the month. And then next month, I'll have a new set of objects, new set of constellations to look at, new happenings. Now, the thing is, if I've only done 2 or 3 observations during the month, suddenly I'm into the next month and I haven't seen much. So I've kind of missed the month, and suddenly the skies shifted round a month, and it's surprising how quick it shifts. Mm. And the other thing is, now the evenings are drawing in quick, things have moved on. So, the sky is completely different this month than it was done last month or the month before. So, yes, things are moving round, and it's all happening. It's all happening.
So what are you hoping to see then in October?
Well, this month it's really Saturn. Saturn is really, really well placed, and it's in Pisces, which is under the great square of Pegasus. And last week I had the camera out the telescope I've got, which is I've got an 18-inch Quattro, which is a really fast telescope, really designed for light stars and deep sky stuff. I thought I'll have a look at Saturn, see what I can pull out. Well, I overexposed everything, because normally you'd take a long exposure so you can get your galaxies and your stars and your nebula into your image. Whereas suddenly I've gone from 8 and 10 and 20 seconds, suddenly I'm down to a quarter
and a tenth and a twentieth of a second.
Oh.
Because suddenly Saturn's that bright, it just overexposes. But what I did pick out was I got a load of the moons like Titan and Iapetus and Celadus and Dione. Now, some of these moons I've not seen before, and I've pulled them out on a long exposure, whereas normally on a short exposure, you just get Saturn and you can't see the moons.
Oh.
So there is, yeah, because they might be magnitude 12 or magnitude 10, where Saturn's like magnitude 0, and the range in intensity and brightness is vast. So if you're going to get a really crisp photograph of Saturn, you're not going to see the moons. Now, you photograph the moons, you get an overexposed image of the Saturn, you can't see the moons.
Isn't that interesting? So in all your career of sort of looking at the sky, you've never seen the moons?
Oh, I've seen the odd moon, yes. Yeah, you can see Titan quite easy. But what I'm saying is, from my back garden, it is challenging because of light pollution. But on the photography, I'm developing ways of like cutting the light.
Of getting around that. So that seems to be your mission for this year then.
Yes, yeah, cutting out the light pollution. But some people are taking photographs of Saturn and the moons. Now, I think what they might be doing is taking two separate exposures and combining them together, which is another technique, which is only photo editing. So, yeah, it is technical. But obviously, when you're looking through a telescope, your eyes can compensate for the light, so you can see a right wide variety of brightnesses, but the fainter moons around Saturn I've not seen, but I can pick them out on a photograph.
Wow. So things are moving up then. So it sounds like now this very specific what you've got, Phil, 8-inch quattro telescope.
The quattro, that's what I say.
So is that the one you got for a significant birthday?
It was, yeah.
It is, and you're seemingly very proud of that, aren't you?
Well, I wanted to take more deep sky fainter objects, which I find more interesting. I mean, the planetary stuff is niche in itself. Well, if you look in the sun, that's niche. The moon's niche. The solar system is a niche subject. And to photograph all the different planets in all of the various phases and points in the solar system is challenging for every single one of them. And this is why you tend to find, like Mick Nichols, for instance, specialises in the sun. Now, what you do to photograph the sun is completely different when you look.
Yeah.
So, the moon's other special. You might want a refractor, a large refractor, to look at the moon, whereas my reflector isn't best suited for looking at the moon.
You're a planets man, aren't you? Oh, yeah.
Well, it's nice to see the planets, especially when they're really big, and you can see the belts, because that's another thing. Saturn's very, very close to Neptune at the moment. Now, in the small window I had last week at looking at Saturn, I tried to photograph Neptune, and I couldn't find it. I'm putting myself out there. I'm being a bit embarrassed saying this, but Neptune is one of the harder planets to find.
Is it?
It's a lot fainter than any of the others, and it's a dim. So I'm going to be trying this next month, trying to photograph Neptune.
And what colour's Neptune, out of interest?
He's like a bluey colour.
I read something about the colour of it, that they always thought it was bluey-green, but actually...
Well, Uranus is further round in the morning, which will be coming round next month and the month afterwards, and it's quite close to Jupiter. So I did a really good photograph of Uranus last year. I'm going to try and get a better photograph of Uranus because it's higher in the sky. And this year and next year will be about as good as Uranus gets, because it's right up in Taurus, which is near the top of the ecliptic, which means it's high up in the sky. So when it comes round later on this year into the evenings, it'll be a really well best place to find. And you'll be able to see it with some binoculars.
Wow.
You can see Neptune in binoculars, but it's very stellar. It looks very, very much like a star. And picking the stars, Neptune out of the stars is a bit more tricky. But it is moving very slowly, so you can see it move between the stars on a weekly basis. So anyway, it's something I've got to get my head around. So Saturn's really, really good. at the moment, and it's also near Neptune if you care to find it. Now, if you go on your Stellaria map, you'll be able to find Neptune and Saturn quite
even though you couldn't then.
Well, I had a small window of time to do it in, but
we'll let you off.
I thought I'd photographed it and I hadn't.
So you'll have a chance in October, all be well then, will you?
Well, this next month I'm going to have another stab at it.
You're going to have a go at it. What else was I going to ask you now about? What else is in the sky then? Is there any...
Mercury is coming round. Is coming round in the evening at the end of this month. Mercury will be setting after the sun, and it'll be its highest elongation, which is highest in the sky. I think on the 30th. So at the end of this month, we're going to be looking out for Mercury late in the evening. Venus is a very early morning.
Not your cup of tea then.
Not my cup of tea. Mars is very, very close to the sun, so you're not going to see Mars. But really, you want to be looking at Saturn this month and Neptune, which will be the best month to see it in. And then probably next month, we'll start looking at things like Saturn, Jupiter and Uranus. And also Ceres, which is the largest minor planet, is really, really good this week and next week. It's kind of due south late on, midnight-ish. So I'm going to try and photograph that. Photographed it last year, and I could actually make a disc out of Ceres. So I think Ceres is about 900 to 1,000 kilometres in diameter. Oof. So you can make it. It does look a bit different to a star, but it's basically white like a star. But you can make a small disc out of it. So that's quite a challenge to do as well, finding Ceres and perhaps following that. It is moving fast between the stars. So if you take a photograph of Ceres, it'll move from night to night very slowly, but you'll be able to see it moving between the stars.
Amazing.
I got a really, really good photo of it on my iPhone the other year.
Do you make a list of what you want to see then? The months that are coming up.
Yes. It's good. The worst thing you can do, especially as an amateur astronomer, is, well, I'm going to set my telescope outside that and see what I can see. That's not the way to do it. The best way to do it is I'll get a star atlas or get on your computer and use the Celestron app or use
Stellarium.
Yep, Stellarium. And basically see what's in the sky. So it's getting dark at 8 o'clock. Say you would go out about half 8 to 9 o'clock. Get your gear out at 8 o'clock while it's still twilight. Set things up, get all your everything ready, and then have an hour, by which time it'll be cold afterwards. And you can basically say, well, the moon's going to be up or Saturn's going to be in the right place. You might have trees in the way, you might have houses in the way, you might not have a clear view to the horizon or wherever you want to look. So you want to take that into consideration.
Ah, yeah.
Basically, work out in your house, in your nice
where you can see.
Where you want to, yeah. Do you need binoculars? Do you want a refracting telescope? Are you going to be using a reflector telescope? I've been using my iPhone for taking photographs of objects for years now, and I've got reasonably proficient at it now. So I've been taking different images of planets and the moon. I've got some really nice lunar shots. So it's like, don't be looking for the moon first thing in the morning today because it's up in an evening. So you need to know where things are, where the best going to be placed. Like the moon's going to be at different phases. So it's a quarter phase at the moment. So it's up in an evening. So you know what you're looking at. If you're going to be looking for faint galaxies in a fortnight's time, you're going to be wasting your time because the moon will be full. And if the moon's full, it's going to be bright. You're not going to see faint galaxies. So the moon may limit on what you're going to be looking at. So perhaps you're going to be looking at Saturn and Neptune and the moon on them nights. And then when the moon's not up, you want to be looking for your fainter stuff. So yeah, you want to be planning. You want to be planning at the beginning of the month. I kind of plan what I'm going to be looking for, and then during the week, then during the evening, I'll work out what I want to see, what I can actually see, what is going to be pushing my boundaries. and then go out on the other, try and see, find it, or photograph, take a photograph.
Hey, this is all good advice, this. And I suppose if you're starting out and you just think you want to have a go, then you maybe won't have a telescope, but you probably have got binoculars, maybe, or you can get hold of some. And
the
first
thing is learn your constellations. Yeah, if you're starting out, binoculars, eyes and binoculars are the basic things to do. And I still use a pair of binoculars to find the brighter stuff, and then start using your telescope to find
to give you a guide, as it were.
Yes, you don't have to have a telescope to do astronomy.
No, and do you know, if you are beginning, I guess just the moon is easy. Everybody can see the moon, can't they? You don't have to worry about, like the sun, you have to worry about, you can't look directly at the sun, but the moon's
really good starting place.
For anybody,
And you can take an easy photo. I've took loads of photographs through my binoculars with my smartphone, because you can take an image through your eyepiece on your binoculars. The key is to rest it on something or have a tripod so that it's still focus. That's the thing. But to be honest, starting off like that is the best way to get into it, and then gradually build up your development in what you're looking at.
Because it must be quite disheartening. You're starting out and people are talking about, oh, I've seen this like far away galaxy like Neptune, and you're trying to find it and thinking, well, it all looks the same to me.
Yeah, it does. You can easily get lost. You can easily get lost.
And on that note, I mean, you sound as though you're giving a chat to some new astronomers there. Well, I had noticed you were advertising at Maxwell and Swinton Astronomical Society. You've got your observatory at Hoover Stand, near Hoover Stand, should I say, the J.A. Jones Observatory. Yeah. I noticed you're advertising a public, I think it was a public viewing
Friday
evening.
Friday, we had our first PVE of the season. And it was full, I think, in the first half an hour.
It sold out. It literally, you put the tickets up at like 1 minute to midnight and they've gone.
They've gone in 20 minutes.
You need a bigger place. You need to take over Yorkshire Water next door. That's what I say. So,
the problem is, though, being a small club, which is really, really nice, is you do have limits on what you can do.
Yeah.
But I mean, we're a nice size, about 40 to 50 members. It kind of hovers around about that, anything from 30 to 50. Once you start getting over 50 people in a small
it's
club,
it's too much.
It gets tricky.
Yeah.
It's a good number to
But have. You're very active on Facebook, and you're very active on, I think, well, not so much Twitter. Well, I do see stuff on Twitter, but I think Facebook's the one. That's where I see all your adverts, as it were, and so that got sold out. And what were you doing that evening?
We have a format. So what we'll do is we'll split a group of 20 people into two. So we'll have half in the dome with a guided tour around what's in the sky, and then downstairs we'll have the other half of the group where we'll be like doing a slideshow presentation, whether it's on the planets or a specific item at the time, and then halfway through the evening we swap them over so they'll get the other experience.
Because that observatory is quite astonishing, isn't it? If you've never been and you get taken up into the dome, it's like, wow.
It is. It's good. We've designed it and tailored it to our own needs. So, yeah. And it's not nothing like the Palomar, and it's not all robotic.
No.
The telescope we have got robots.
And did actually, because the weather's not been brilliant, did they actually see anything then?
I don't think they did on Friday because it was the weather was so bad.
What we do is we
have a projector upstairs so we can actually show people what they could have seen if it was clear.
But this is it with astronomy. As you say, because I bet you get really narked, don't you? If it's cloudy or you're wanting to see something,
well,
you can't.
I have been this month because I did want to take a couple of photographs that I've not done before, and I just haven't been able to.
No.
The other thing is, some of the stuff, I've kind of got a narrow window looking due south over some fields and then trees either side. So if I want to see something that's low down, and some of the interesting objects are low down, I only have a narrow window to catch it. And then once the constellations have moved on and the light or the moon interferes, you've lost it. So some objects, It's like in Sagittarius, there's some nebulas in Sagittarius. I can only see them in July, August, and then that's it.
Yeah, you know what you need to do?
I can't see them anymore.
You know what you need to do, Phil? You need to build an extension on top of your house. Put a balcony up there and be like Patrick, is it Patrick Moore?
Patrick
no, what was it? Yeah, Patrick Moore used to be right at the top of the house with a window.
Yeah. Well, one of the other things is robotic telescopes. These small sea stars. I mean, you can just take them outside, plonk them on a table, let it line itself up, find out where it is. Tell it to find an object and just take a photograph.
Oh, but that's no fun, is it? That's cheating, Phil.
People are getting some really good photographs, but they're not doing the work.
No, it's self-satisfaction, isn't it?
Yeah, like a smart speaker, isn't it?
I know. Yeah. Anyway, we're going to have to let you go, sadly, Phil, because the film show are in.
Is that a half an hour gone?
It is.
Yeah.
I know. We could rattle on forever, couldn't we?
Well, it's been absolutely a lovely morning.
I know, it has. Thank you, Phil, for talking
to
us. We'll speak to you again very soon, no doubt.
I hope the sky's clear.
I do as well. Stay dry. Bye-bye, Phil. Bye.
Bye.
I need you when you